It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk to a former prison inmate who spent years in solitary confinement. We'll get his perspective on a hunger strike in California prisons and what it means when prisoners protest.
Charles Franklin joins us now. He's the director of the Marquette Law School Poll, and he's here for a look at the latest results released today. Professor Franklin, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, with an eye to the governor's race next year, what are we seeing here about both President Obama and Scott Walker in Wisconsin?
Well, both of them dropped a little bit in this latest poll from May's readings. They both went down about 3 percentage points in their approval rating. For Governor Walker, that was coming down from 51 to 48. For President Obama, from 50 to 47. Now, that is inside the margin of error of the poll, but just barely. But what's striking about it is both of them have averaged a 50% approval rating for the last 12 months. So to see them dip even a little bit below that is interesting, and it's also unusual to see politicians of opposite parties move in the same direction. You might expect one to go up and the other go down, but here both move down. So that's a suggestion that this is something real that has taken a little bit of a toll on both of them.
Well, what does the survey have to say about how polarized opinion is in Wisconsin right now?
Yeah, well, we're awfully sharply divided. There's no question about that. When you look at Democrats and Republicans, they're overwhelmingly favorable towards their party and unfavorable to the other. But interestingly, when we zoom in on independents and moderates, we see that they split in opposite directions, with independents being more favorable to Governor Walker and unfavorable to President Obama, but moderates go exactly the opposite way, being more favorable to Obama and less favorable to Walker. So if you think of those two as the defining swing groups in the state, the fact that they're splitting in opposite directions right now, I think, suggests that looking ahead to 2014, we could see more uncertainty about which way they would break in the 2014 governor's race.
Mm. Well, are we divided based on where we live in Wisconsin? Does that show up?
We are. The city of Milwaukee being the least favorable to Governor Walker and the most favorable to President Obama, followed by the Madison area. But then the Green Bay area is actually the most favorable to Walker and the least favorable to Obama. So we do see a bit of a regional split there.
Well, Professor Franklin, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That was Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette Law School Poll. And now we'll take a look at race in America and how we classify it. Our next guest is a former director of the U.S. Census Bureau, and he says the way America counts by race is wrong, and it's time to do something about it.
Kenneth Pruitt is professor of public affairs at Columbia University. He's the author of What Is Your Race? The Census and Our Flawed Efforts to Classify Americans. Kenneth, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, there was a big change recently in the Senate. It used to be you were one category or another, and you had to pick. Why was the change made to allow people to check more than one category?
Yeah, that took place in the 2000 census, but it had been taking place across state legislatures for the last, and local state-based censuses and information systems for about 15 or 20 years. So, in effect, the experiment was underway, and the federal government simply caught up with the mood of the country that there aren't just a limited number of fixed boxes that everyone has to fit into.
Now, let me ask one basic question before we dig into the details. Why do we want to measure race, or why have we wanted to measure race and/or ethnicity in the federal census?
Well, it's a very important policy tool. If you care about equal opportunity and anti-discrimination, most of those things are revealed to us statistically. When the civil rights programs came along in the 1960s, it was thought we would not need to measure race. The initial civil rights leaders actually wanted to get rid of it, but they couldn't retail their way out of several hundred years of racial discrimination. It took a wholesale effort, and when you're doing policy at the wholesale level of affecting large numbers of people, you need some sort of statistical portrait of those people and their social conditions.
Now, going way back, I think you wrote that in the first federal census, we tracked three different races. Is that right?
That is correct.
So it was white people or Europeans, African-Americans, they didn't call it that back then, and Native Americans.
Correct. And those three races were, in effect, a subset of what the natural historians at the time were calling the five races of mankind. And those five races were really five colors. So you just identified the white, the black, the red, and there were also the yellow, that is East Asians, and then the Pacific Islanders, and they were called the browns. So science of the day already classified us into the entire world into these five large groups.
Now that science has gotten more complicated over time, yet today we still, in effect, are tracking by those five races in the modern census. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. It's ironic that several hundred years after the natural scientists described the world that way, that is still the fundamental framework of the United States Census, despite its enormously much more complex, demographically complex population.
Now let's talk about the census and how we divide up race, because it's a bit of an unnatural and unwieldy concept. How does it get complicated in the form we receive on the census?
Well, the census question itself is something accumulated across time. You had the first three groups that you just mentioned. Then we had a lot of Asian immigrants coming from China, especially workers on the mines, the fields, and the railroads in the West Coast, brought over almost as indentured servants. At the same time, you had began to have a flood of white ethnics, as we referred to in the time, Irish, the Italians, the Poles. And so the census was constantly trying to catch up with this changing demography. And it sort of added things on and took them off, but always it returned to that sort of fundamental framework. So really we ended the 19th century with the same basic three, white, black, yellow, white, black, red, and then we added the yellow, the Asian race, by the time we ended the 19th century. Flirted with the idea of trying to separately count different European groups. I did a bit of that, but pretty well put that aside by the 1920s. So by the time we move toward the civil rights period, we really are working with four major groupings, and that's before we had many Hispanics. And, of course, then as the Hispanic population grew in the 1960s and 1970s, we added that. But we called the Hispanics or the Latinos an ethnicity, not a race. So we really had four races plus one ethnicity. And then a little later, we broke the Asians into two separate groups, giving us, in effect, the brown or the Pacific Islander race as its own category.
As you're describing it, it's getting kind of unwieldy. There's race, there's national origin, there's ethnicity all mixed in. What is the flaw? What is the problem with that system that evolved up to the 2010 census?
Well, in effect, the fundamental flaw is that we need to have a more refined understanding of particular population groups. There are the Korean Americans, the Japanese Americans, the Chinese Americans are doing very, very well, but not the Laotians, not the Vietnamese, and so forth. But they're all statistically in the same category, so we call them all model minorities. Well, that's an inaccurate description. Or another example. We are now getting a very high rate of new immigrants coming from African countries, from Ethiopia, from Ghana, from Nigeria, Kenya. Now 1.5 million of those new immigrants, and they're statistically put in the same grouping with African Americans and Caribbeans. So there's no internal distinction, and it's very, very difficult to do school reform policy or language policy. Civil justice policy without beginning to see what particular groups are in what kind of social conditions, educational advance, getting jobs, learning English, and so forth. The five big groups just don't give us the detail that we need.
We're talking with Kenneth Pruitt, former director of the U.S. Census Bureau, author of What Is Your Race? Coming up, we'll talk about what he'd like the census to look up moving ahead.
Well, what do you think? Do you think the U.S. Census should ask about race and ethnicity? Do you have a hard time deciding what to check off? You can call us or email. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or shoot us an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Vera. This is Central Time. We are talking with Kenneth Pruitt, former director of the U.S. Census Bureau. His new book is called What is Your Race? Looking at how the federal government measures race in America on the U.S. Census. Want to know what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you think the government should be asking what race we are, what ethnicity we are? Do you think they should do it differently? Are you confused about what to fill out when it comes to that because of your background? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@wpr.org. Kenneth, I just promised I'd ask you what we should do differently. What kind of changes would you like to see in the way the census works?
Let me say rather firmly that radical change, fast change, abrupt change is not likely. There's enormous inertia in a question that we've been asking for over 200 years. So I actually think change has to be introduced incrementally. But the and as generations turn over, we now have a generation that really you could call the multiracial generation. They've grown up with biracial statistics and thinking about multiculturalism. They're much more comfortable with mixed up identities. And I think by the time they're adults, they'll be ready to sort of look at a new way to have the society measure itself. So my big strategy that I recommend in the book is we continue to ask a race question, but simultaneously ask a much more detailed national origin question, and then look at the interaction between those two data sets to get a bigger picture, a better picture of the society. And perhaps in another generation or two, by 2060, 2070, we'll begin to go entirely to a national origin question. We'll have a much more sophisticated way to take the census then in any case. With drop-down menus and so forth. So we can do this technically. We simply have to wait until there's a political momentum behind changing the way we do it. So when I say I want to change things, I don't expect radical change by 2020. I do think we can put in place some new ways of asking the question by 2020 that'll retain our current statistics but add to them. And then gradually we'll have to see how the population responds. But the people who grew up with the old five categories are, after all, now in their 60s and 70s. So as we are replaced, and I'm one of them, as we are replaced, I think we'll have much more welcoming of a more more detailed and granular type of census set of questions.
Now, when you're talking about national origin, is that something that if you were born in the United States, you'd just say the United States, or are you kind of capturing your genealogy? I'm of Polish and Scottish origin or something like that.
The question will certainly allow that. A lot of people like to talk about their German origins or their Italian origins. The chances of that being important, it's important to them to declare that, fine, but we're not going to find important patterns of discrimination or upward mobility that necessarily cluster by those self-categorizations. But where people say, well, I'm Vietnamese or I'm Turkish, we may well find that that characteristic still has bearing on how well they're assimilating into American society. So let everybody put down whatever they want, and then we find out which of those things correlate or pattern themselves by all kinds of other variables, such as educational success, job success, and so forth.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Isaiah in Lac du Flambeau. Isaiah, hi.
Hi. I'm an epidemiologist, and I work at the Great Lakes Intertribal Epidemiology Center, and we struggle with these questions all the time, especially with what counts as an American Indian. Is it somebody who's American Indian only? Are they still American Indian if they're American Indian plus one other race, plus two other races? And whose data do we look at, the census data or the tribal data? And I just think the way we figure it out right now is not working, and I wish there was a better way to do it. And with American Indians, their nationality, what do they put, their tribal identity, or do they put their American, like they say they're American, even though that kind of puts them in with a totally different group of people?
And Isaiah, before you go, I want to know, this affects the work you do in epidemiology, right?
Absolutely. They say, what is an epidemiologist? And I tell them it's somebody who stays awake late at night worrying about denominators. And we have to figure out what those are. And I think with American specifically, there are certain things that American Indians can qualify for due to the trust responsibilities with the American government, like healthcare, for example. And so how they classify those things makes a huge difference. It's not just something that we try and figure out who's getting ahead or who isn't getting ahead. There are certain specific legal ramifications with that.
Isaiah, thank you so much for calling and sharing that. And Kenneth, this is something that the census has struggled with, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The caller just made the point as well as I can make it. So more than happy to have him say what it's like out there in the world of epidemiology and public health research as you're trying to sort things out that simply don't sort very well. The American Indian is a very special population. Some people are American Indian by virtue of being on reservations, others by declaring a tribal identity, but they live in cities. They don't live on the reservations. The health care needs of those two different population groups are simply different, and they're different across the Navajos, the Cherokees, the Iroquois. All of those things are lost if the only thing you've got is something called the American Indian population.
And you make a similar case for African Americans in the United States. You talk about the concept, I think it was from the columnist Eugene Robinson, of multiple Black Americas out there. And how can we measure that just with this one box on a census?
Yes, and basically what Eugene Robinson's getting at is you've got a lot of internal differentiation by social class. That's true in every one of our race groups. I would like to see much, much more analysis, not just of the race categories, but the way in which race intersects with social class.
Thanks a lot for the call, Isaiah. We've got Doug with us now calling from Waukesha. Doug, hi.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I had the opportunity to be a census worker at the most recent 2010 census. I went door to door for the individuals who had not completed the postcard and mailed it in and completed the census at their residence. And what I found, more often than not, the most difficult concept to get across to the people that I was speaking to was some of the things that we're talking about now. That, for example, on the most recent census, Hispanic, as pointed out, was not considered a race but an ethnicity. And those individuals who wanted to identify themselves as Hispanic as a race, and white people who didn't necessarily want to identify themselves as a block of a color, but rather as an American. We had several of those, and according to the rules, we could only ask them so many times what their race was before we had to write down what they specifically said. I'm kind of curious how this is going to play out if we do move, which I think is a good idea, if we do move to national origin. How does that play out for those people who may want to identify themselves as, for lack of a better term, a color group, as an African American or a Hispanic American, in other words, a group that would not see themselves as solely an American, from the wholesale perspective that the census director had spoken about.
Gotcha. I'll jump in, Doug, because I want to get a response. Kenneth, thanks, by the way, Doug, for sharing the story from the front lines. How does that work, Kenneth, in your suggested system of national origin if somebody wants to keep using that old group?
Absolutely, that fits. The extent of the question would make that clear, and the examples would make that clear. My guess is the African Americans will continue to call themselves African Americans for the rest of the century or beyond. There'll be many hyphenated American groups. On the other hand, the Ethiopians, the Ghanaians, who've just been here for 10, 15, 20 years, their kids are just now assimilating, going to school, they may much prefer to identify themselves in terms of their more immediate country of origin. The point is this will unfold, and we'll learn about it as it unfolds and make adjustments as appropriate. We're now stuck. If we don't do something differently, we're going to be stuck this way for another 20, 30, 40 years. So I'm eager to get something going that will unstick us, and then it'll play out. But we need much more flexibility in the system to allow the distinctions that were just mentioned by Doug to play out.
Now, you're talking about this and asking for some big changes. Is this a one-man conversation, or are other people saying similar things?
Yes. Thank you. well, look, a lot of people are talking about this. I've certainly talked to my friends, especially in the civil rights world. They're very worried about any kind of change. They're very locked into these particular categories as they've known them. On the other hand, they will certainly tell you that, well, we don't want to keep doing it this way for 60 or 70 more years. And my answer to them was, if you have a better way to get us out of this, everybody thinks we're stuck. I don't mean everybody, but large numbers of American people have all the kind of confusions that have just been mentioned, and say, well, help me out. I want to do a better job. I want to describe who I really am in a way that makes sense. So all I've done is written a book that says, let's decide that we're not going to be asking the same question in 100 years from now, and let's start making a change now that will get us to a different kind of future.
Kenneth, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
That was Kenneth Pruitt, former director of the U.S. Census Bureau. His book is What is Your Race? Talk about changes in the census system. Keep the conversation going at the Central Time Facebook page. Did you get stymied in the last census on the race question? Tell us about it at the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a former prison inmate who spent years in solitary confinement. We'll get his perspective on a hunger strike in California prisons and what it means when prisoners protest. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about some of the zany new food on a stick we'll see at this year's Wisconsin State Fair.
And some old favorites, too, like the cream puff.
But first, we're talking to a former prisoner who spent 12 years in different kinds of solitary confinement. His story, three consecutive all-white, all-male juries found Wilbert Rideau guilty of murder for the death of a teller during a bank robbery.
In 2005, a mixed-race jury acquitted Rideau of murder and found him guilty of manslaughter. He was sentenced to 21 years in prison, and since he'd already served 44 years during the appeals process, he was immediately freed.
He wrote an op-ed for the New York Times last week in response to the tens of thousands of California prisoners who went on a hunger strike to protest prison conditions. That strike started on July 8th.
He's here to tell us his thoughts on the prison protests now. Wilbert Rideau, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, Veronica.
Can you tell me what went through your mind when you first heard about the hunger strike among these California prisoners?
Well, most people were just looking at the fact that, hey, these guys are on hunger strike and, you know, it's not much of a big deal. But the fact is, number one, the size of it is simply amazing. It's unprecedented that, you know, you're talking about two-thirds of the state's facilities, over 30,000 prisoners. We've never had prison protests of that magnitude in the history of this country. And the other thing that I know, having been a prisoner, I realized that for that to happen, you have to understand, you know, while popular perception is that prisoners sit around plotting and scheming to make trouble for the authorities because they're bored to death and have nothing better to do, or because they hate them. And that's fiction. That's something that's promoted by prison managers and movie makers. The truth of the matter is that a prison protest is extremely difficult to pull off in prison, not to even mention the size of this one. And that's because the established order in prison, the inmate power structure, works against prison protests, and they work to prevent it. Nobody wants a prison protest because even the innocent in prison are punished if they just close to a prison protest have nothing to do with it. The innocent is punished as well as guilty. So, you know, the typical guy doesn't want trouble. He just wants to serve his time and stay away from that.
Okay, so given that, can you give us a sense about what it would take for prisoners, and a huge percentage of them, like you just said, what it would take for them to decide to make a gesture like this?
Things would have to get so bad that they feel that, understand, they're dealing with, in prison, you're dealing with absolute power, and because that's what authorities have. And pulling off a hunger strike or any type of protest in prison is much the same as armed conflict in Syria or a hunger strike in Guantanamo. You're spitting in the eye of absolute power. That's declaring war. And you're always going to come out on the losing end. The thing is that it has to authority will have to have pushed the line of tolerance so much until they just feel compelled to do something. I mean, the prisoners just feel that they're sort of desperate because they feel they have no more options to resolve their grievances, whatever their grievances are. When they feel that authority has abused their powers and they have no options, well, that's when you get a protest. But you got to push them pretty much against the wall.
Now, this protest is largely about the overuse of solitary confinement, according to these inmates who are on hunger strike right now. And you have served yourself 12 years in solitary confinement. You served longer than that. 12 of them were solitary. But what would you say about that aspect of it, the solitary confinement being so objectionable that this is what the prisoners decided to do?
Well, solitary confinement, it's taking a person and isolating them for years in a cell, and understand, it's about the size of the typical bathroom. That's the cruelest thing you will ever do to another human being. I mean, think about having to stay in your bathroom for 1 weekend or 1 week, let alone 30 years, like Tommy Silverstein has stayed in the federal supermax prison cell over in Colorado, or Albert Woodfox and Herman Wallace has spent over 40 years in a cell here in Louisiana. Think about where were you 40 years ago, and just think back from that time, and you'll realize just how long that person has been sitting in that one little box, totally divorced from everything else. And, you know, when you do something to somebody like that, what you're doing is, I doubt if you take, the typical person they pretty much take it for granted. You know, all the small everyday interactions that you get, you know, with neighbors, with coworkers, with taxi drivers or waitresses. You know, all these people give you feedback every day that reinforce your sense of who you are and your place in the world. And until you suffer such deprivations, you don't realize just how important that is, because when you deprive human contact and that type of social interaction and all that external stimulation, you lose the context for your being, you know, for who you are. And then you start to deteriorate. And over a certain amount of time, you're going to lose your connection to the world that you once knew.
Now, I suppose that the people in charge of keeping this prison running, they might say that solitary confinement is a necessary tool that they've got to keep order and to lower violence. What would you say to that?
Well, they do say that. In fact, they've got an excuse for everything they do. They've got a rationale for everything they do. But if they're doing all that, why are they having a hunger strike? If everything is hunky-dory and peaceful in the place, everything is right, and the prison administration is doing right, why do you have a problem? Why? What are they protesting for? It only happens when people get desperate. And I don't think when you keep somebody locked up in a cell for 40 years, you're not talking about controlling violence. This is ludicrous. I mean, you're talking about an entire lifetime, and usually a lot of these guys haven't done anything. From what I understand, over in California, a lot of them are because of who they believe they associate with. Whether they're associated with gang members or, you know, it's an allegation, and the only way you get out of solitary confinement is you have to snitch on somebody else and tell them that, hey, look, so-and-so, you know, this other guy's a member of a gang. Well, can you imagine the amount of lying that's going on, or fabrication, just to get out?
Now, you've actually spent 12 of the years you served in solitary confinement. Since then, you've gone on and you wrote an op-ed about this prison strike in the New York Times. You have been an NPR correspondent. You work on documentaries and as an editor. But I wonder, even with all that under your belt now, Do you still think back on solitary confinement, and has it changed you?
Veronica, solitary confinement, let me tell you this. The other thing you did mention is I wrote a memoir in the place of justice, and I was told to write a sample chapter. I wrote about solitary, and that sold the book. Yes, I think about it. You don't ever lose that. I mean, I probably can, unlike a lot of people, it didn't break me. And, because like I often tell people, you know, you're always hearing about guys, you know, broken and destroyed by that. Yes, I saw guys commit suicide. I saw guys who were crushed by the experience and ended up just empty shells of what once contained a human being. But that didn't happen to me. You know, it's all in what you take into that cell with you, who and what you are. And, I guess it's kind of like a religious experience. Some people are improved by it, and others are crushed completely. But, yes, I think about it. I think about not only that, but the entire prison experience. It's part of who I am. You don't spend 44 years in the military or in any other place, and it's not part of you.
Well, Wilbert, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Wilbert Rideau, a lecturer, capital defense consultant, and the author of that book you just mentioned, In the Place of Justice, A Story of Punishment and Deliverance.
Coming up next, we'll talk about some new foods we can expect to see at the Wisconsin State Fair this year. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Wisconsin State Fair opens August 1st, and while there's definitely a lot to do, and even if you don't indulge in a single hot dog on a stick, the occasional indulgence of State Fair food is a Wisconsin tradition.
Here to tell us about this year's new offerings is Kathleen O'Leary. She's the Director of Marketing Communications for the Wisconsin State Fair. Kathleen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you.
Now, I hear there are over 70 new menu items on this year's list. What are you most excited about?
You know what? There's so many that are so intriguing that it's really kind of awe-inspiring, if you will. I love potatoes, being a good Irish girl. So I'm very interested in the garlic-buttered new potatoes on a stick. So not one of the more crazy out there ones like the brown sugar bacon-wrapped hot dog on a stick, but that one kind of stood out. So that's definitely one that I'm going to go try at Joey's Tempura stand.
Yeah, that one you could eat, and then you could have a cream puff afterwards and maybe not feel too bad. Potatoes on a stick, that's, you know, it's a vegetable of sorts.
There you go.
Suspiciously healthy. I don't know.
Well, actually, you know what? When you come to the Wisconsin State Fair, there are no fat grams. There's no guilt. There's no calories. It's all about just coming and having a wonderful time and grazing your way through.
So there's, something like 21 menu items that are prepared on a stick. What's the deal with food on a stick at the State Fair?
You know what? I believe it's really the fair industry as a whole, and it all stems back. I mean, again, we're so steeped into tradition and history. I mean, this is our 162nd Wisconsin State Fair, and it's just, you know, it starts with the corn dogs, the cotton candy, the caramel apples. You know, so you really think about those traditional items, and now there they all are on that stick. So as our vendors and as just, you know, the consumer in general becomes a little more innovative and a little more edgy, that's where some of these new, crazy, creative ideas, and it also stems from when you think of the fair, you think of the what we call in the industry the pitchmen, the people that are out there with the sham wows and the salsa makers. So you kind of get those little more quirky, crazy things. So I think they took it from there, and then they decided to, like, put it to the food side. So now we have everything from, back to that brown sugar bacon-wrapped hot dog on a stick to, you know, this new hot pretzel with bacon and chocolate sauce on a stick.
Do you get a sense that these vendors are getting a sense of pride in coming up with the wildest, wackiest thing that gets everybody's attention?
Well, here is, and it's just such a perfect segue into something that, yes, to answer your question without a doubt, they really, really try and break themselves out of the clutter. And we've watched it now over the course of the years just get more exciting and more out there. So we, this year, for the first year, created a food competition. And we challenged our food vendors to come up with really exciting, novel ideas that you wouldn't ever think of, and they had to all be new, and they couldn't have that been anything that had been on their menu or any other menu for that fact. So we had 42 of our vendors come up with all different ideas. We narrowed it down. We actually created a panel, a judging panel. We narrowed it down from the 42 entries down to 8. So now these 8 finalists will all come together on July 30th. We will have celebrity judges to come out on the 30th, and we will judge and come up with what we're calling the Sporkies. When you come to the fair, it's a stick. Is it a spoon? Do you need a fork? Do you need a fork and a knife? So now it's the Sporkies. So it will be the Sporkies Award, and this is like showing an animal for our youth in our great state that they vie for that blue ribbon. These vendors are vying for this Sporky Award. And when you come out to the fair, which opens in 9 days, you'll be able to see all of the 42 finalists will be showcasing the item that they entered, and then the 8 finalists will also be showcased with a different type of indication. It's like a little flag that you won't be able to miss, and then certainly the Sporky winner will also not only be announced in the media, but will also have some other way to really showcase that that was the winner of the 2013 Sporky Award.
Excellent. Well, we'll have to keep an eye on the winner of that one.
And here, I'll just share with you quickly, the Thanksgiving waffle is a finalist. Island Slaw, which is from our island noodle vendors.
No, wait, what is a Thanksgiving waffle? I got to know.
It's got some stuffing in it. It's got some turkeys in it. It's got some cranberry. It's all those great things that you come to love over Thanksgiving.
On a waffle.
All in a waffle.
Gotcha.
The
Rochester
slider is in there. Mac Attack is in there. The Melafrida gelato on a stick is in there.
Hmm.
Iced Irish coffee float is in there. And the deep-fried peanut butter and bacon nuggets with Barry Weiss jelly. And then the 8th one is the Cajun mac and cheese.
Oh, I'd eat that. That sounds it's not on a stick, though, right?
That one is not on a stick.
Wow. So those are some adventures in Wisconsin eating for you right there. I have to ask you about another one that's on the list of the 70 new items, the Krispy Kreme burger with spicy pig candy. What is that?
And I wish that I could answer that question for you, but it's going to be bacon-related.
Bacon-related.
Yeah.
So it sounds like it's a burger on a donut.
It is the burger. The Krispy Kreme is the bun, and the spicy pig candy will be bacon with a coating that has a bit of a spice to it.
Wow.
Do you think
it's crispy.
Do you think the food itself is part of why some people go? I mean, you know, yes, there's all the animals. Yes, there's the rides on the Midway. But are people doing some food tourism there, and that's why they're at the fair?
You know what? There's no question that it's one of the mainstays. And when we do our surveys or, you know, we hear consumer feedback in a variety of different ways that we gather that data, yes, food is really right up there with entertainment. And then certainly, you know, being the agricultural showcase, there's no question that, you know, seeing the animals in the barns and having that be part of your experience are the top three, you know, experiences that people are looking forward to all year long at the Wisconsin State Fair.
What's kind of nice about it is it's not highbrow. This is egalitarian food. It just tastes good. It's probably, let's be honest, it's probably not that good for you, but it's fun to try things and see what you like and see what these creative cooks are coming up with.
You know what? It really is. It's something different. You know, we all love to do our routine type of things, but when you come to the Wisconsin State Fair, it's really the last bastion of Americana. Is that a great way to say it? In the sense that this is what we are all about. It's about the family network, the idea of gathering together, whether it's the gathering of family or the gathering of friends and family, but people are coming out to be entertained. And the beauty of the fair industry, but the Wisconsin State Fair in particular, is it's very individualistic. Even just the three of us right here, I mean, we certainly have all of our listeners hearing this, but, you know, your idea, Veronica, is very much different probably for what you're going to be looking forward to than mine, and likewise. But everybody gets something. Everybody gets to have a takeaway when they come here, and you can spend, you know, 2 hours or 8 hours. And certainly people come multiple days because you just can't do it all because there's so much.
I'm guessing Rob might like the deep-fried taco cheesecake.
That might be a little intense for
no.
me. No, but there were some,
okay, what
some...
about the Cajun frog legs on a stick?
I would try that.
And we're getting healthier.
Yeah, protein.
Protein.
And Cajun, that's an interesting twist.
It's in their tropics, that's Joey's Seafood, excuse me. Joey does a great job with his coconut shrimp and all of those, so that's going to be an interesting one. And certainly frog legs on a stick, frog legs in general, but then on a stick, you know, again, where else would you? And it goes back to what I said earlier about where else would you walk away with a salsa maker and a ladder that extends, you know, 75 feet. You didn't even know you needed it. You quite frankly, didn't even know it existed. And then the next thing you know, you're sitting next to somebody you didn't even know, but now you're buying the 2-for-1, and you're leaving with a ladder, a blue mop, and a salsa maker.
Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, and it's so wonderful. We're going to open up the gates in 9 days, and we're so excited because it's not our state fair. It's your state fair. And it's something that you really should come out to. If you haven't, please do, because this is really the celebration of everything we should be so proud of in Wisconsin.
Kathleen O'Leary, I'm going to jump in here. Kathleen O'Leary is the Director of Marketing and Communications at the Wisconsin State Fair that opens August 1st.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll look at President Obama's major address on the economy. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.